Hello and welcome to This Week in History Class. I'm John Larson. This week in class, we are going over a number of different things. We're actually going to finish up World War II and take the test Thursday. But what I want to do right away is get to our first student history extras. I'm very excited about this. The first one we're going to do actually deals with slang in the 1950s. We're going to get into the 1950s now in that area after World War II. So, again, this is Slang. It's presented by Kira Dahl.
My subject for the History Extra is slang of the 1950s. There were a lot of phrases in use then, many of which are, surprisingly, still used now. One usage that was radioactive back then was hipster, a person who was very in the know and up to date. They used cool, yes, cool was popular back then and still is now, words such as cat, a fellow hip person, nuggets, referring to loose change or money, and raunchy, something dirty or gross. To fracture a person was to amuse or really impress them, and to neck was to kiss or hug. To be hep, or in orbit, was to be with it and keeping up with the times. You didn't want to be a freem, a person who didn't fit in, or square, a conformist and opposer of the new movement, and especially not a nosebleed, someone who is stupid. Some of the words used then and still in use today are baby, grody, nerd, and party pooper. The usages of some have changed, such as spaz, which used to refer to a klutz but now means a person who panics easily, and weed, which used to be a cigarette but now means, well, marijuana. A lot of hipster slang came from jazz. Jazz, back then, was not just music but even an entire lifestyle. Beat, or beatnik, was another way to refer to this culture. The attitudes of these groups paved the way for the later decades of the 1900s.
Thanks, Kira. Now we're going to look at sports in the 1950s with Zach, Nolan, Sam, and John. Take it away, guys.
I'm going to talk about players from the sport of football in the 1950s. Otto Graham was a quarterback in the Pro Football League. Graham played from 1946 to 1955, all seasons being with the Cleveland Browns. He led the Cleveland Browns to the championship game all 10 of his seasons, winning 7 of the 10 championships, not to be confused with Super Bowls. He threw for 23,584 yards and had 174 touchdowns in his career. Also finished with a 55.8% completion rate and threw 135 interceptions. Graham was a 6'1", 196-pound right-handed quarterback. Otto Graham was the quarterback every team wanted. He could throw the ball, run the ball, and lead the team to victory. Graham wore both number 14 and number 60. He was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1965. Dick Night Train Lane was a cornerback in the Pro Football League. Lane was in the Army 4 years prior to playing professional football. Lane played from 1952 to 1965. He played his first two seasons with the Los Angeles Rams, then played for the Chicago Cardinals from 1954 to 1959, and finally finished his career by playing with the Detroit Lions from 1960 to 1965. Lane finished his career with 68 interceptions, returning 5 for touchdowns. Lane was not only used on defense, having 253 yards on only 8 receptions. Lane wore number 81 and was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1974.
Now some time for some hockey. Hockey wasn't too big of a sport in the 1950s. With only a few television shows airing hockey, it was pretty much invisible. Most NHL players in the 50s were Canadian, but a few were American. In the 1950s, there's only 6 teams, which were Toronto, Montreal, Chicago, Detroit, New York, and Boston. In the early 50s, Detroit dominated the league, but as the years went on, Montreal started to dominate by winning 5 Stanley Cups in a row. Stanley Cup winners of the 50s were 50 Detroit, 51 Toronto, 52 Detroit, 53 Montreal, 54 Detroit, 55 Detroit, and 56 through 59 Montreal. One of the greatest players of that time was Gordie Howe, who played for Detroit. Gordie Howe led the points in every category. Being born on March 31st, 1928 in Canada, Gordie Howe joined the NHL in 1946 and played 26 seasons in the NHL. Shooting right-handed, he led the league with over 1,700 goals throughout his career.
Now we will talk about baseball in the 1950s. One of the best players in the 1950s was Mickey Mantle. He played for the New York Yankees. He made his debut at age 19, and he played in the MLB for 18 years. By the end of his career, he had hit 536 home runs. Mantle won the MVP award three times throughout his career. In 1974, he was inducted into the Hall of Fame. Mickey Mantle is considered by most baseball fans one of the best players ever.
And now let's talk about Hank Aaron. Hank Aaron made his MLB debut on April 13, 1954. He had a total of 755 home runs. Hank was in the All-Star game a total of 21 times. Also, he was a member of the Major League All-Century team. Hank Aaron held many MLB records, such as 6,856 total bases, 2,297 runs batted in, and 1,477 extra base hits. Barry Bonds is the only player with more home runs than Aaron, and he is suspected of using steroids during his career. Well, thanks for listening to This Week in History class. Stay classy, JLRS History.
Thanks, guys. And now we turn to Aaron, who's going to tell us a little bit about the plays and musicals of the time period.
The 50s were a time of huge progress on the Great White Way. Musicals that many people now consider classics were just being introduced to Broadway and were receiving praise from people of all backgrounds. There were musicals that brought together two entirely different lifestyles and made them into one unforgettable story, such as Guys and Dolls, which wove religion and nightclubs into the same story, or West Side Story, which showed the conflicts between Americans and Puerto Ricans in New York City, while retelling the old tale of Romeo and Juliet. Both of these musicals ran on Broadway for several years and drew in audiences of all kinds that could relate to the musicals in some way. These shows taught lessons of acceptance and equality to all who saw them, and provided a positive message and teaching moment amidst the fighting and horrors of war. Another popular musical, The Music Man, was a little closer to home. It takes place in the fictional town of River City, Iowa, and revolves around a con man and a librarian falling in love. Classic love story, right? The townsfolk of this show are terrified when the con man tries to corrupt their town and make them all look like fools, which is how many people felt at this time. They all had hometown pride and were ashamed if a soldier from their city became a traitor or died for nothing. A story that really hit home with many people was The Sound of Music, which told of an Austro-Hungarian submarine captain, his seven children, and their governess trying to stay loyal to Austria during World War II, while the Nazis converted people all around them. People understood the struggle of their once friends, changing their loyalties or watching their loved ones go off to war without a choice. People ached for the relief that this family was granted, even though Americans weren't forced to flee to the other countries like the Von Trapp family had to do. While some of these shows did not actually take place in the 50s, they all influenced the people of America during a time of war. The economy was booming, and people wanted to think of something other than the death and destruction across the seas. Musicals played a big part in the growth of not only Broadway, but of the people of that time and how these stories taught them life lessons that they passed on to generations after them.
Thanks, Aaron. And finally, we have Jenna telling us about some of the ramifications of what's going on in the 1950s and the Cold War itself.
Welcome to This Week in History. I'm Jenna Anderson, and I'll be doing one of the History Extras this week. In this History Extra, we're going to look at the Cold War. Well, not at the Cold War, but more about after the Cold War, meaning what we have left today as a result of the Cold War. I'll try not to bore you all too much. The Cold War left us with quite a few things and helped us advance a lot more. One of the most used today is the interstate highway system. Yes, I know roads aren't that interesting, but before the interstate, it took 62 days to get from East Coast to West Coast, with little to no sleep, as done by a military convoy. Now it can be traveled in about 5 days. Big difference, right? Ever heard anything about the interstate having a mile of straight road to every 5 miles for planes to land if needed? Well, it's not really true. The highway is big enough to land planes, and sometimes they are landed in emergencies, but it wasn't built for that intended purpose. Two of the main reasons it was built was to be an evacuation route to the shelters to protect civilians from nuclear bombs. It also made sure our troops could move quickly in case we ever get invaded. Thankfully, it hasn't been used for either of those, yet. Santa Tracker. An amazing thing, right? Well, Santa's tracked from NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, built in 1958. It is found 2,500 feet inside Colorado's Chenay Mountain. Originally, it was intended to track any nuclear weapons strike from Russia. It has long since passed that purpose. Now, it monitors all of the airspace in North America, and of course, follows Santa. Have you ever been up late at night when your screen goes blue with a bunch of warnings of a test? That would be the emergency broadcast system created in 1963, so the president could alert the public to war, impending war, or great national crisis. Like a few of the other things left by the war, it has yet to be used for any national endangerment. Now on to the fun stuff. Nuclear warhead stockpiles. Of course, not so fun if you have the threat of them hanging over your head. Russia still has about 5,200 nuclear warheads readily available, while the U.S. has about 9,600. Of course, only 8 of those are needed to wipe out almost all life on Earth. The last thing I'm going to briefly touch on is a secret, the U-2 U.S. spy plane. Capable of taking clear pictures from 70,000 feet in the air, this plane is made to spy. Of course, it wasn't a secret anymore when the Soviet Union shot one down in 1960. Cat's out of the bag, I guess. Although the U.S. does still fly about 50 of them. Well, that's all I have for this History Extra. Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned for next week's History Extras.
Thanks again, Jenna, for that. Later this week, we'll be looking at the 1950s coming up, but first we have a test that's coming up on Thursday. That's just a little reminder. I want to thank everyone who participated in this podcast. It was a lot of fun. I think we had a lot of really good things, and I'm looking forward to the future. Find us on Twitter at TWIHC, or you can find me at Twitter at Teacher J Lars, and I'm on Instagram also at Teacher J Lars. Next week, we have another bunch of students that are going to do a great job on their history extras. I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm excited about where this is going to go. This again is John Larson. We'll see you next week.